The Movement Brainery.
In order to grow and to learn, you really need to fail. And so I luckily professionally grew up in an environment where my failures were actually celebrated as an opportunity to figure something out I didn't know. And my failures with patients, because I had a system where, okay, I'm not getting the right thing with this patient. Let me send them here, send them there. All I cared about was learning what I was missing.
You're listening to Masters in Motion, a limited edition podcast about physical therapy leaders and their stories so that we can apply those same lessons to our own lives and the challenges that lie ahead. Vicki Johnson is one of the most optimistic people you'll meet. And that's why this was one of the hardest interviews I've ever had to do. Vicki grew up in a small town in Georgia and graduated high school early, her family halfway around the world in Tehran. Initially unsure of what she wanted to do, Vicki jumped back and forth between wanting to be a lawyer, then a nurse, and then a doctor, before seeing physical therapy in the back of a magazine and applying, and getting accepted with zero experience with the profession. Later, Vicki and her husband Greg Johnson, another physical therapy legend, started a continuing education company that at one point had over 100 courses per year across the country, while also having a multi-clinic private practice and raising two young kids. Even in the face of all those barriers, Vicki still wouldn't admit to being stressed. In fact, as you'll hear, she describes herself as filled with excitement for the profession and the capacity to change patients' lives.
We are in Steamboat Springs. I'm sitting in a front room just staring out at the absolute crystal blue sky, not a cloud in the sky. It just snowed really a lot yesterday. So we have this beautiful white winter wonderland reflecting all of the sun. It's absolutely beautiful and peaceful.
And so you're in Steamboat Springs, Colorado right now. Where did you grow up?
A little tiny town called Smyrna, Georgia. And then I went to and got my degree in physical therapy after quite a circuitous route.
A circuitous route? What happened?
I was out of high school when I was 17. My parents lived overseas in Iran, so I was kind of on my own. So I started school, and my original intention was to be a lawyer. And then my dad sat down with me and said, why don't you get a nursing degree? And while you're getting your law degree, you'll be able to work at something that you'll enjoy, and it'll also be good exposure to people in that arena. So I said, that sounds awesome. So I went to nursing school and absolutely fell in love with the whole medical field, and then switched from nursing to med school. And so began to satisfy almost, and it was funny because I'd already done 2 years of nursing by the time I switched. Even in the 70s, physical therapists had a certain autonomy with their patients. And I could also balance my work with my personal life, which I knew even before I got married that being a mother was going to be very critical to my life.
Do you remember your first exposure to physical therapy? How'd you hear about it?
I was sitting on the floor in my bedroom in Iran on one of the first nights of a trip over there where you don't sleep all night because of the time change. And I had determined that I wasn't sure I wanted to continue with medicine, more because of the inability to find that balance in personal and professional life, and also time with patients. So I literally took a catalog from the Medical College of Georgia and began to flip through the catalog. And when I opened to the page of physical therapy, it spoke to me. And I set up an interview. It was obviously meant to be, because they accepted me and I had zero experience in PT. And the only thing I knew was my mother had gotten PT at some point in her life.
Wow.
Yes, it's one of those things where the stars aligned and I was luckily paying attention.
Wow. So then you start physical therapy school. Did you get good grades or were you a good student?
I had like a 4.0 going into PT school, and I would have graduated summa cum laude, but by the spring of the second year, I was burnt out and I literally just skipped the class to play tennis in the morning. And so because they didn't fail me, because that wouldn't have allowed me to graduate, they had to give me a D. So I lost my summa cum laude position. So still graduated cum laude, but it was, I had good grades. I was a very good student. I had great study habits. And I think more importantly is I loved the content. I loved studying the human body. I loved understanding movement and how the brain worked with the body from the get-go. And also my program, Maggie Knott was very dear personal friends with the neuro faculty, Dr. Myers. And Maggie would come to the Medical College of Georgia every other year and spend like 6 weeks teaching at our school. And so I had this exposure to PNF as a student, and to say it wowed me is being very understated. I was absolutely overwhelmed with what I saw as potential to change patients' lives using PNF. And I chose my affiliations based on PNF. And so I think that from the very beginning, my future was being shaped by being in a program that was speaking to my heart.
And did you immediately go to the residency program at Kaiser?
Pretty much. I had chosen my last clinical affiliation in San Francisco, because when I applied to the PNF residency program at Vallejo, at the beginning, probably the middle of my senior year, I was told there was a 12-year wait list to get into the program.
Wait, there was a 12-year waiting list? Why was there such demand?
Because Maggie Knott and Dr. Bobeth, Berta Bobeth, and people like Irma Myers, and there's a few others that were in the profession at that time, they were challenging physical therapists to become more. They were showing us as physical therapists we could do more. They were giving us tools and techniques to assess our patients differently than we'd ever done before. And they were helping us realize our potential. And so all therapists around the world that wanted to be better saw this as an avenue to go into that could really give them that edge to help their patients be the best they could be. So it was in demand because it was a training that you walked away from empowered and with an incredible high level of skill. And so I chose to go do my last affiliation of the United States Public Health Service in San Francisco so that I could be close to Vallejo and go up there and make a personal appearance and get myself on an expedited wait list. I got tired of me annoying them, and they said, Bobby was her name, she was the admin, she said, Vicki, you're on the list. Well, that December, just when I landed in Tehran to visit my family with for Christmas, Dad meets me at the gate telling me I made it in the program. So I had to turn around, fly back to the United States, pack all my stuff, and drive from Georgia to California. So I started the residency program on January 3rd, 1978.
Wow. So was that just your exposure in physical therapy school that made you so interested in doing this program?
Well, it was my exposure in PT school that drove me to my second affiliation, which was at Charlotte Rehab Center in North Carolina. And the director of that program had been Maggie Knott's assistant for several years out at Kaiser Vallejo in California. Then she came back to spearhead and manage the rehabilitation program at Charlotte Rehab. And then my immediate CI, what had just finished the 6-month residency at Kaiser. So when I arrived at Charlotte Rehab, I was inundated with PNF. And the very first week we had an in-service right after work on Tuesday. And Pat Payne was her name, the director of the program. Pat brought in an incomplete quad, laid him down on the mat, and asked him, dropped his leg off the side of the mat and said, I'd like you to pick your leg up and roll over. Well, of course, you know, the quad couldn't do anything. And I'm standing there thinking, how awful. How is she, why is she even asking this guy to move his leg? That just seems so wrong to put him in that position. So I just watched as in 5 minutes using PNF, she was able 5 minutes later to drop his leg off the side and say, now pick your leg up and roll, and he did it. And I went, oh my God, I want to do that to my patients. And that's when I signed up for the program.
Yeah, so off you go to California. And if you could give just a little background, looking at the program, this was 40 years ago. It was 6 months long, so different than a lot of the programs these days.
And the only way you got in from the U.S. was if one of the foreign students couldn't get their visa or couldn't still come.
Yeah. So you headed over there and worked with Maggie Knott. What was Maggie like?
Again, I got in on I started January 3rd, and Maggie was only there for 6 weeks after I came. And 6 weeks later, she stopped working for good. And she passed away December 18th of 1978.
Hey guys, real quick. If you like the show and you want to connect with like-minded physical therapists trying to improve their own clinical practices and their thinking, just like many of the greats that we interview, then you've got to join our community. Just punch over to Facebook and search for the group Mindful Clinicians. We'll be waiting for you. Thanks.
During that year, we became very close because of the fact that my first 4 weeks there were Greg Johnson's last 4 weeks. Greg was like, Maggie never had children. She never got married. Greg was like her surrogate son. She loved him so much. And she was from the South and I was from the South. So from the get-go, Maggie was telling Greg he was going to marry me. So we were very close. So I got to see a different side of Maggie. That was so committed and so caring. In the clinic, she was like a general. I mean, she'd been in the Army. She was like a general. She'd walk into a room and she would just terrorize everyone. She'd stand over you trying to give you feedback and you'd be shaking so hard because you wanted to please her so bad because you wanted to do it right. And yet she didn't know how to break it down and communicate. She was a gifted artist. She could touch infants 6 months old to adults 80 years old, every diagnosis you can think about, and you just watch them change in their movement potential and understanding of their body immediately. It was an artistic gift, and she was trying to share that gift, but she was hard for her to teach, and she would become very frustrated if you didn't just automatically duplicate what she was doing. And I think that's why she and Greg connected on such a deep level, is because Greg Johnson, he is the same way. He has, except he was gifted with both the artistic gift of treatment and the ability to break it down and teach it. And so Greg was a very pivotal person, I think, in PNF being what it is today. Because Greg worked with Maggie for 7 years. He duplicated everything and even added more to what she was doing in terms of PNF. But when he was with a group of people, he was able to really get them to understand and think about what they were doing with their hands and lay the foundation for what now is the Institute of Physical Art.
Yeah. So you go through the program, and what happened after the program? What did you do?
Well, I met Greg while I was in the program. We began dating. So when I finished, 6 months after I had started, which was in the summer of 1978, Greg and I began our clinical practice together and began setting up the foundation for the Institute of Physical Art to begin offering continuing education to therapists in the country.
So you graduated in 77, and in 78, you were opening a clinic and then deciding you were going to teach across the country?
That is correct. No one ever accused me of being shy.
I mean, that's pretty driven. Why do you think that you dove into it so quickly?
Well, the private practice was a no-brainer. Greg was already starting. He had left Kaiser to start his own private practice. As I said, he'd been at Kaiser for 7 years. And I'll kind of explain where he was headed in just a moment, but it was the reason that he was ready to go into private practice. For myself, I was so drawn to be mentored by him. So there was never a question that wherever he was working, I wanted to be working, because I just wanted to suck him dry with all of his knowledge and understanding of the human body. And I was so inspired by his desire, kind of as Maggie had done in the 50s and 60s, trying to take us to that next level. That's what Greg was doing in the 70s. He was breaking outside the norms of what physical therapists were doing in terms of their treatment of orthopedic patients. And he was saying, guys, we're just missing this whole component, and it's called the fascia, and we're not even addressing it. So it was Greg Johnson that, you know, branched out and brought soft tissue mobilization and the understanding of fascial treatment into our profession in the 70s and early 80s. And so I was so drawn to be under his wing. So I went into private practice and to teach, that was, people wanted to learn. And we were, instead of having to go to Kaiser for 3 or 6 months or to Northwestern for 6 weeks, we could come to them. And it was the first time that this type of continuing education was becoming available to physical therapists. If I could give you perspective, in the 1970s and early 1980s, if you were to take the physical therapy journal and open it up, you would find maybe 2 pages at the back of the journal. And in those 2 pages, maybe 4 classes listed where people could get continuing education and post-professional education.
Wow.
It was not an integral part of our profession at that point. Most of our continuing education came from going to state conferences or national conferences or doing mentoring underneath the giants back then. There wasn't this huge multi-million dollar industry called continuing education. And you know, now we probably have 1,000 providers of continuing education when you go to all the different places where you can learn. Back then, there were very, very few organizations that brought education to the consumer and made it in a palatable way, because it was only 3.5-4 days. Occasionally there'd be a full week, and every now and then there was like a 2-week educational opportunity. So it was very, very different back then.
Wow. So you guys started with the Institute of Physical Art, and what was your goal?
Our goal was to help physical therapists discover their potential, to change patients' lives, to be all they can be.
And you guys started to branch out and teach across the country. Did that take off pretty quickly?
Well, in 1978, we taught our first PNF course. We taught 2 of them in 1978 locally, more or less in the Bay Area of San Francisco. People that had already heard of Greg had contacted us. And in 1979, we taught, 8 or 10 courses. As far away as Hartford and Oregon and Atlanta, down in Miami. And then next year, it kind of went up to about 20. And then by the 1982, we're teaching around 30, 40 classes around the country. And part of that was PNF, but there was a huge interest in the area of soft tissue mobilization because, again, it was so unique and not known within our profession. And so this whole thing of treating the whole body, looking at the myofascial system, it was brand new. And there was a lot of interest in that. So we were teaching PNF. And back then we were teaching PNF predominantly for the neurotherapist population. And we were teaching, back then we called it Functional Orthopedics 1. And because functional orthopedics was getting us to look at more of the orthopedic population, but we were integrating PNF into the orthopedic course. And that began to lay the foundation. And then Greg developed Functional Orthopedics 2. So gradually, as our clinical practice expanding and our understanding of the human body expanded, we developed coursework to be able to impart that information to other people. And those who had studied with us trusted us to bring to them skills and clinical reasoning that they could use with their patients. So when we would offer a new course, there'd be a lot of people who were ready to jump in and try that course. And then just by word of mouth, things began to grow.
Wow. And if I think to that growth, I mean, so you started off and then quickly it was 20 courses and then 40. And here's this girl from a small town in Georgia who wanted to be a mother. When did that happen?
That was very intentional. I told my husband that before he even asked me to marry him, I said, you don't even bother to propose unless you're ready to be a daddy, because I have to be a mom. And so we got married, and I was around 25 and I got married. I had my first child at 28 and my second one at 31.
Did you run into any issues, you know, being a mother, and how did you balance that and then this private practice and this big continuing education company?
My blessing is that I have been gifted with enormous stamina and endurance and energy. Most people around me, they say, Vicki, you burn the candle at both ends, and I don't even know how there's any candle left, because I definitely have a lot of energy. And but I will tell you that for me, it was always a very natural division of focus, because my family always came first and my work second. Whenever there was a conflict, there was no debate or struggle as to how to resolve that, because my family came first. So when I became a mother, I still worked endless hours, but I manipulated those hours around the hours that were important for my children. And I cut my clinical hours to part-time so I'd have time. I did a lot of the business work late at night, and was able to be the mom I wanted to be. And that was the whole goal of being a therapist, is I could have a flexible schedule, still see patients, but still teach. The teaching was kind of a fun thing, because my husband and I set it up where we'd each be gone every other weekend. So like, I'd be gone one weekend, then we'd have a family weekend, then he'd be gone, then we'd have a family weekend. And so it gave my husband a lot of really great one-on-one time to be a dad with the kids, because when mom was gone, it really allowed for extra special bonding. So my son asked me, my oldest son, Ryan Johnson, he's a very, he has the vice president of marketing and research and development with the Institute. And he kept asking me about the sacrifice that I had to make professionally to be a mother. And I kept saying there was no sacrifice, because sacrifice insinuates that there is a desire to do something other than what you end up doing. And there was never that desire. There was always a desire to be the mom and then enjoy being the therapist. So I'd have to say I feel like I balanced it pretty well, given the endless number of hours I had to work. And I'm very proud. I have two very successful sons, one in physical therapy and one in music, which is extremely hard to do.
That had to be challenging. But yeah, it sounds like you guys at least had some discussions about it and you know, settled on a plan that worked.
Yes, and I had a great partner in both business and life.
Yeah. Kind of going back to the business, in 1984, I saw you opened up a spine center with an orthopedic surgeon, and that was the third clinic. So again, not only was the continuing education company expanding, but your business was expanding quickly. Was that something that you guys had to work hard at, or did that just happen organically?
Great question, Seth. It happened organically. And I love that you use that word, because I can't think of any other word that would better describe it. And that really was the entire process of Greg's in my life, has been a very organic evolution. We've never been the type of business people that said, okay, now if I want to make this much money, I need to open this clinic and do this and teach this many courses. Everything that we've always done has been a spontaneous response to a need. We've never planned to do something to grow. And in fact, the growth sometimes was a little overwhelming, but we always felt it was necessary to meet the needs of those that we were serving. So in the case of the original name of the clinic was Marin Spine and Orthopedic Center. So in the early 80s, we had been working very closely with a physician who was at that time kind of head of the spine surgery organization within the medical society. And he was very well known and very well respected. He did Joe Montana's back surgery. And Dr. White had always been very interested in back school. And he felt like it was a missing component for his back patients. Therapists went in and gave exercises, but we didn't really educate them enough. And so as we began to know Dr. White, we already had this one clinic in Marin that was a predominant manual therapy clinic. And then we had this other clinic in San Francisco that was a very successful manual therapy clinic. And so we kind of got together with Dr. White and accepted a challenge more than anything. And it was kind of like, we want to open this clinic literally in the same block as your other clinic. But we want this clinic to be just about education and training. And if they need manual therapy, they'll go down the street. But we want patients in this clinic to get educated and to be trained how to be responsible for their body. And we're gonna have psychologists and social workers and Feldenkrais workers and Aston patterning trained therapists and occupational therapists. We want everyone that can do anything to teach a patient how to better take care of their body. And as far as we knew back then, we were the first business partnership between physical therapists and physicians in opening an outpatient clinic in California. Stanley Paris had kind of dabbled a little bit of this in Atlanta area, but we were kind of setting a standard here that we can be a partner to a physician, not just an employee. That all those principles and the understanding of movement and motor control and all that came out of the fact that we had to focus on how to make our patients better pretty much without touching them for a while.
These courses, it sounds like at least the core first course, so you developed that just through things that you were experimenting with in the clinic?
That is how every course for the IPA. So PNF was not just teaching what Maggie taught us. PNF, our original course that we taught, was sharing with other clinicians how to take PNF and how to let it be the foundation of your manual therapy. F01, functional orthopedics, was introducing to other professionals, okay, we're using soft tissue mobilization in the clinic, and these are the changes that we're getting. Let me show you the skills that we're using so you can go do that. Back in the early days, we called Core First Strategies back education and training. Okay, we're realizing that we're not really fully serving our patients because we're just mobilizing them and getting their tissues more, the mechanics fixed, and we're teaching them exercise, but we're really not educating them. We're now doing this in the clinic, and this is what we're finding and how it's changing our patients' lives. Okay, we're going to teach you those skills and that process and that clinical reasoning.
Yeah. I mean, later on, if you can reflect on how you learned when you started all this, you were kind of, a relatively fresh PT and you started a clinic. Do you think you learned more from your clinical practice? Do you think you learned more from teaching? Or how do you think those played into your development as a PT?
Great question. First of all, the first probably 3 years after I finished Kaiser Vallejo, I was playing catch up with my husband. So I was taking anything out there where I could go and study with someone. So whether it was a Paris course, a Grimsby course, a 2-week Maitland course, I was just inundating myself with opportunities to learn. And it was all out of pocket. There were no continuing education funds back then, especially if you owned your own practice. But even when you work for hospitals, things like that weren't done. But I spent every penny I made on advancing my understanding of the human body. And then I would come back, and every weekend that I wasn't in a course, Greg was hosting these gatherings. I can't think of any other way to say it. In the Bay Area, we just had a huge group of therapists who were just so hungry to learn. And we'd all get together every weekend, every Saturday, and we would play with the human body. We would discover, we'd say, well, what happened? This isn't moving here. How do we make this move? Or why aren't they pulling in their trunk when they're pulling this leg? Or Why is C1 not moving on C2 when they flex first and then rotate? And we just play with all these challenges that we were seeing in our patient populations, and we would challenge each other to think deeper and to try harder. And it was such a great learning opportunity that was not just driven by the availability to learn, but driven by the passion to want to learn. And, you know, you've heard this more in the last few years, but they talk about how in order to grow and to learn, you really need to fail. And so I luckily professionally grew up in an environment where my failures were actually celebrated as an opportunity to figure something out I didn't know. And my failures with patients, because I had a system where, okay, I'm not getting the right thing with this patient. Let me send them here, send them there. All I cared about was learning what I was missing and trying to figure it out. Yeah. And then I had to take that and try to teach it. So that the more I taught, the better I became at the clinic, because I'd go teach, and in teaching, someone would ask me a question that I'd never thought about before, and I'd have to explain something on a different level I'd never even tried to analyze before. And that way, when I came back to the clinic, I was now looking at my patients in a totally different manner. So it was an incredible circle of learning. There was, I can't really weigh one of the clinical practice and the education more than each other, because they were so intricately tied in together.
Yeah, I mean, and one thing that surprised me at the beginning here, you said you took more courses. So you were teaching all these con ed courses. So I have to keep coming back to this. Were you ever overwhelmed?
Well, I didn't have children for about 5 years, my first 5 years as a PT. So I did not consider it being overwhelmed. I considered it being just so thankful that I had so many opportunities. Like going to Disneyland the first time, you can say you're overwhelmed, but as a kid, you're not feeling overwhelmed. You're so excited. You're just like, oh my God, there's another ride. Oh, can we go do this? And can I do that one again? And I want to do this ride. And the parents are overwhelmed, but the kid is in heaven, because the kid is just celebrating and so exciting about all these new stimulus and new exciting things to participate in. And that's kind of where I was. I mean, I was, thank goodness, not hidden away in some hospital where no one cared about anything but just doing their job and going home. I was in the hotbed of creative learning. Northern California was just this hotbed of desire to know and understand the human body. And there were so many people there that brought so many different aspects to the table. And I wasn't overwhelmed. I was just excited.
And eventually you guys started teaching internationally, right?
Yes. Well, Greg taught a couple of classes internationally very early on, but we actually, our first real venture into education internationally was in India, where we went into partnership with the Times of India to open up a clinic in New Delhi. And so we would go over there and do continuing ed with all of the people that were affiliated with that company. And then we began to teach our classes in Japan, because there was a huge group of Japanese therapists that wanted to get certified through our organization. And then we started, together with Gregory Paprocki, who's from Poland, we started IPA Poland, which we go over there and train the therapists in the classes there, and are working toward a certifications over there as well. And then we've taught in Brazil and a few other. Greg's taught in England and he's taught in Norway. So, I mean, we've done individual classes in different countries as well.
And now IPA currently, how many courses are you guys up to?
We are having this interview at the end of 2020. So let me kind of roll the time back to the beginning of 2020. So in 2020, our company was scheduled to provide education through about 165 different in-person continuing education classes. And obviously, the entire world has had to reorganize and re-envision how to continue this process.
Yeah.
Everything shut down in the spring of 2020. But we spent endless hours studying, understanding the virus on the day-to-day revelations that came through the all the research and the hospitals that were working firsthand. But the joy was that our virtual was evolved, and it evolved out of necessity. So coming now into 2021, the IPA is offering about 60 in-person classes this year and about 20 virtual classes. And we're very excited about that number. And I feel like there's been a very organic shift in the structure of our company because of COVID. And I'm not sure that that's not a good thing. So for right now, we're going to go small and, you know, keep our total number of offerings to around 80 seminars a year and just kind of see where that leads us as we navigate this, the uncertainty that still exists around COVID. And then we'll see what 2022 brings.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly what the next step is. I know that Greg and I will continue cutting back a little bit, but we do have others in faculty that have been with us that will probably take over the helm for the IPA. And so I kind of see, I know it's going to continue. There was a point in 2020 where we were not sure if we were going to be here, Seth, this year.
Yeah.
But we are, and we're so blessed. But it was during that time that Greg and I received so many emails and phone calls from people all over the country, other countries, just saying, please don't give up. please don't let IPA go away. And it was that knowledge that we were impacting our profession on such a deep level. They gave Greg and I the courage and the stamina to keep going.
Yeah. You've taught a lot of PTs over your career. When you reflect on that and you look forward into the next 100 years of PT, what do you think most PTs need to do better in the clinic?
That's a great question as well. So Greg and I, through our organization, not one-on-one personally, but we have an incredible faculty that we've trained over the years, have trained over 50,000 therapists, both nationally and internationally. And we like to think that because of that, that the work that we have done has impacted millions of patients in a positive way. And over the years, Greg and I went from saying there was always an underlying clinical reasoning, but the clinical reasoning's role became more and more prevalent and coming to the forefront of what we really needed to teach as the years went on. And that led us to where in the late 90s, we defined what we taught as functional manual therapy. And we defined functional manual therapy as a clinical reasoning system of both assessment and treatment. And that all the skills we teach for both assessment and treatment are important, but they're only as important as the understanding that comes from using a clinical reasoning system. And so what we tell therapists when they go back to the clinic is, first of all, develop your skills for clinical reasoning by developing your skills for observation and developing your pattern recognition. There's been a lot of research that has shown that the difference between a master clinician and a novice clinician is their pattern recognition. And pattern recognition is a difficult thing to accomplish because you've got to be willing to fail to truly achieve pattern recognition. But you need a system to help guide your development of your pattern recognition. Your intention to notice creates your library of reference. But that is a foundational principle behind the science of pattern recognition, is one's intention to notice. And that's always been what we encourage therapists to do, is you've got to intend to notice everything about every patient that walks in your door so that you're gathering this information. And then you've got to create within your mind ways to file away information, not compartmentalize, but organize So there's where we came up with our functional manual therapy system, which is mechanical capacity, neuromuscular function, motor control. And we don't just give lip service to each of these. We truly teach in every class how to understand and notice and pay attention to the mechanical aspects of your patient, the neuromuscular aspect, the motor control continuously throughout your treatment and your visit, and be able to gather information that lets you integrate this knowledge and put forth a plan of care that will allow you to address them as a whole human being. As an individual, we are not just a mechanical system. We are not just a neuromuscular system. And we are for sure not just a motor control system. We're a human being that's meant to have locomotion, movement to interact with our environment. And we tell our therapists that we train, we're going to give you structure to help you observe and gather information, but then we want you to develop your skills so you can be creative and meet the needs of each of your individual patients, no matter what their pathology is.
Yeah, so it's the thinking.
And it's not taught. Unfortunately, there are very few programs in the United States. I am so blessed because Dr. Bellamy, she developed what was called in the 70s the problem-solving curriculum. This is why she was so well-respected within the educational division of the APTA. She developed this program, and she said, it's less important what we teach than how we teach our students to think. And that's been kind of the underlying premise for Greg and I. You can have great hands and never affect change if you don't know how to apply your skills within a reasoning system that is looking at the total interconnectivity of the human body.
Yeah. So, and Vicky, as you look into the future of physical therapy, what do you see?
I see a need for passion to learn. I see a lot of young therapists coming out of school. And in this modern world of everything being electronic and easy to access, I don't see a lot of therapists coming out of school with the same drive and same passion that my peers and I experienced back in the 70s and early 80s. We teach classes that sometimes go 10 hours, even 11 hours, and I hear a lot of moaning and groaning. I can tell you classes that I would attend that would go 6 days in a row from 8 a.m. till 10 p.m, and no one complained. We just wanted more. And I think we need a passion that drives us to want to be the best we can be. Not just the best so we can just make our patients better, but the best we can be so we can go home every night. And we know that, you know what? I've given my profession 110%. So I don't need to bring it home with me now. Now I can go have that other life because I know when I'm at work, I'm giving 110% because I'm driven to know as much as I can about the human body and to develop my skills and to pay attention. And that actually being successful in one part of your life actually opens up the potential to have another life because you're not constantly spilling over with regret or need.
Yeah. So this lack of passion, what do you think is the cause of that? And do you have any solutions for it?
I think it's generational and it's not across the board. I mean, we have a ton of young professionals and students who are still in school I have students in the last 10 years that by the time they graduate, they've taken every one of our core curriculum classes. There are those out there. I'm not trying to say it's across the board. But I think it has to do with what I said, that things are so easy to access now and easy to come by. And, you know, we became doctorates, so we feel like we have already a certain position. And I just tell therapists when I teach them, your degree is your license to learn. That's what your degree is. That's your license to learn. The learning starts now. You have all your basic knowledge. Now you're going to learn how to be an expert and master clinician.
Yeah.
And get mentorship. Mentorship is so needed, and not mentorship where someone just watches you do a technique and two or three times and says, okay, I can check you off on that technique, or mentorship where you're required to watch, you know, videos or participate virtually with classes. I'm talking about mentorship, the kind that we offer through our residencies and fellowships. Day in and day out, you're there with your mentor. You sit down every day at lunch and you share your failures and try to figure out what you're going to do different. You can call someone in the room at the drop of a hat and say, can you just look at this real quickly? I don't know what I'm seeing or feeling here. That's the kind of mentorship we need.
That was Vicki Johnson of the Institute of Physical Art. IPA has several fewer classes in 2021, but head over to their website to see what they're doing near you. I'll post that in the show notes. And again, if you like the show, please consider two things for me. One, leave a review wherever you're listening. It just takes 2 seconds. And then head over to Facebook and join us in our group, Mindful Clinicians. See you there. Thanks for listening. Stay strong.